hearty greetings to our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Welcome to another expanded 30-minute edition of The Sunny Side of Sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to The Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports Show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
They've been standing up and cheering in Glasgow, Scotland. That's where the Commonwealth Games are taking place. It's the ninth day of competition at the International Sports Festival, which has featured nearly 5,000 athletes from the Commonwealth nations. The games will come to a close on Sunday. Nigeria received some bad news Friday when it was announced that 16-year-old weightlifter Chika Amalaha, the gold medalist in the women's 53-kilogram division, had failed a drug test. Amalaha was found to have taken two drugs that are banned as diuretics and masking agents. Amalaha is facing a doping ban and the loss of her gold medal. Meanwhile, another Nigerian teenager won a gold medal Thursday in the women's long jump, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Little-known 18-year-old Nigerian Ese Brume clinched a gold medal in the long jump with a leap of 6.56 meters on Thursday. Fellow Nigerian Blessing Okagbare added the 200-meter gold medal to her 100-meter title, while South African Cornel Fredericks won the 400-meter hurdles in 48.52 seconds. Nigel Amos won the 800 meters to hand Botswana their first medal of the games. Kenyan David Lekuta Rudisha and South African Andre Olifir followed across the finish line, while sprinter Lehata Mosito improved his Lesotho 200-meter record to 20.36 seconds.
The Voice of America.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Let's take a look at the medal table now at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow. With medals still to be awarded on Friday, England was on top with a total of 129 medals, including 45 gold. South Africa is the top-performing African team. The South Africans are seventh overall, with a total of 37 medals, 12 gold, 10 silver, and 15 bronze. Nigeria is one place behind the South Africans at eighth overall. The Nigerian team has a total of 25 medals, 8 gold, 6 silver, and 11 bronze. And Kenya is 10th overall in Glasgow with 14 medals, 5 gold, 6 silver, and 3 bronze. Other African countries that have won medals at the Commonwealth Games are Cameroon. Cameroon has 7 medals total and is 15th overall. Botswana has 1 medal, that's the gold, won by Nigel Amos in the men's 800 meters race. Mozambique has 1 silver medal. Ghana, 2 bronze medals. Namibia, also 2 bronze medals. And Mauritius, Uganda, and Zambia all have 1 bronze medal each. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook. The address is facebook.com/VOASunny. I posted a photo of Nigerian sprinter Blessing Okagbare at my Facebook page. Blessing has a big smile on her face as she carries the Nigerian flag around the track after winning her second gold medal at the Commonwealth Games. As you might expect, my Facebook friends in Nigeria enjoyed the photo. Let's sample a couple of their comments. Austin Njoku, who works at the National Human Rights Commission of Nigeria, writes, and I quote, "Queen of the track, we are proud of you. All hail Queen Blessing Okagbare. You are indeed a blessing to Nigeria." Magnus Chisholm Onwuadiwe, the humble apostle of the sunny side of sports, writing from Abuja, Nigeria, says, "Great blessing. She did us proud. More kudos to her."
Hello, this is Magnus Chisholm from Nigeria. I love listening to the sunny side of sports. It's always a daily delight of listening to the sunny side of sports. Once again, Magnus Chisholm from Nigeria. I'm wishing all the sunny side of sports listeners all the best. Bye.
Because this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited. Ni chabulile. Hola.
Because this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
Voice of America.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America. Joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sonny, and good evening to all the football lovers around the continent.
David, the South African Football Association has hired a new head coach with the nickname of Shakes to shake up the national program.
VOA!
Can you give our VOA football fans some details?
Yes, Sonny, the headline writers had a field day, of course, for the appointment of Shakes Mashaba. His full name is Ephraim Shakes Mashaba, but everybody calls him Shakes. In fact, they call him Bra Shakes, in other words, Brother Shakes. And we've had the Shakes rattle and roll, etc., etc., etc. But an interesting appointment, Sonny, because before it took place, the general feeling was that two overseas-based coaches were going to be those in prime positions to take over. One was Carlos Queiroz. Now, he is Portuguese by citizenship, but he was actually born in Mozambique, and he was with Iran at the 2014 World Cup. He had previously coached South Africa for a couple of years, between 2000 and 2002. But although the South African Football Association deny this, I suspect that his demands for 2 million rand a month were just too much for the South African Football Association. Another person whose name was constantly mentioned was Stephen Keshi, the Nigerian. Now, South Africa have had coaches from Europe, they've had coaches from South America, and they've also had their own local coaches. But what they've never had is a coach from another African country. And opinions were very divided on Keshi. Keshi was another World Cup coach in Brazil. He became the first African coach to lead a side into the second round, Nigeria eventually going out after a 2-0 defeat by France. But while many people would have welcomed Keshi, who's a no-nonsense person, and they felt he was just the one to deal with the prima donnas in the South African lineup, and there's plenty of them, Sonny, believe you me. Others felt a little bit uncomfortable having a Nigerian, a lot of sort of friendly competition between Nigeria and South Africa. So in the end, what happened was the announcement came that Ephraim Shakes Mashaba was the unanimous choice. Now, I personally welcome it. He has a very good record. Also, he's not sycophantic. In previous times, as either caretaker coach or full-time coach of the South African team, he has clashed regularly with officials. Shakes is very much his own man. He's 63 years of age. He's a former defender with the famous Soweto club, Orlando Pirates. And when it comes to developing talent in South Africa, he's out on his own. He's top of the table. He has discovered many of the footballers who are now in the senior national team. The one thing, Sonny, that he doesn't have an awful lot of, though, is time. Come early September, South Africa begin their Cup of Nations campaign away to Sudan. And just a few days later, they face their bogey team, Nigeria. And how interesting it would be if Stephen Keshi, whose contract has not been renewed by Nigeria, but latest reports from Lagos say that the Nigerians now want him back, he could well be on the opposite dugout to Sheikh Mashaba. So that could be a really razor-sharp match, Sonny, on the touchline as well as on the field.
David, on a lighter note, how did Coach Shakes get his nickname?
Sonny, I've tried very hard over the last few days to get that. I was expecting that question. It's a very relevant one. And I heard about 50 different interpretations of it. The one that seems to be most common is that when Shakes tackled you, he shucks the bones in your feet. And then he became known as Shakes. But trust me, Sonny, the headline writers, he is an absolute boom for them. They've been having the time of their lives in the last few days. If you think of Carlos Quiroz, not an awful lot you can do with that name. But Shakes, oh boy, they're having, you know, he's going to shake up South African football, et cetera, et cetera. But a tough time for him, Sonny. As I said, Nigeria are the one team South Africa just don't seem to have an answer to, particularly when it comes to competitive football. South Africa have never beaten Nigeria in a competitive match. And on September the 10th, those two sides meet in a South African venue yet to be named. And that promises to be a battle and three quarters. VOA!
David, if our VOA listeners have a football-related question for you, can you give us your email address?
Yes, certainly, Sonny. It's david.leg, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France Presse, .com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.leg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com, and we'd love to hear from you.
We would love to hear from our listeners. So if you have a question for David, soccer or football related, please send it to him and we will try to read your question on the air.
Voice of America.
David Legg also wants our VOA listeners to know that he's formulating another African football quiz question down the road. You're going to hear it on the Sunny Side of Sports in David's most recent African football quiz. We had two winners from Zimbabwe, two winners from Nigeria, and one winner from Manchester, England, and they're all going to be receiving some of those delightful Voice of America goodies. In cycling, our big story this week was Vincenzo Nibali, the first Italian to win the Tour de France in 16 years. Nibali dominated cycling's greatest race nearly from the start in Britain. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, let's listen in again to this report from Paris from Lisa Bryant.
Eh bien, illégal sur ce Tour de France. Vincenzo Nibali, vainqueur.
29-year-old Sicilian Vincenzo Nibali cruised to victory on a summer's evening in Paris, winning by a total of 7.37 minutes over Frenchman Jean-Christophe Perrault. Another Frenchman, rising 24-year-old star Thibaut Pinot, was third overall. German Marcel Kittel won Sunday's final stage in a sprint finish. Nibali is the first Italian to win the Tour de France since 1998. He's also only one of six cyclists to win all three Grand Tours, France, Italy, and Spain. His victory came after pre-race favorites, defending champion Chris Froome of Britain and two-time winner Alberto Contador of Spain, bowed out earlier with injuries. Speaking from the victory podium at the Champs-Élysées, Nibali said it was one of the most beautiful moments in his life. He thanked his team and his family. Thousands of people watched the riders make their final loops in the French capital, ending a race that began in the British city of Leeds on July 5th. Matthew Antony had cycled here from London with a medical group.
We finished yesterday a four-day ride covering over 330 miles. And we're celebrating today by seeing a bit of professional cycling, seeing how fast the real people do it.
14-year-old Natalia Mestering is from Toronto.
Amazing. This is honestly an experience of a lifetime. I'm so excited to be here.
Pierre Gonard from the French city of Rouen was here with his father.
On est content. Il y a beaucoup de monde.
The Gonard said they were happy to be on the Champs-Élysées to watch the riders finish. They've seen the tour before in the mountains when the teams flash by in seconds. The riders lucked out on this last 137.5 kilometer leg of the tour. After enduring stretches of rain and cold during the 3 weeks, they ended with sunshine for their last stage of the 101st Tour de France. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Now let's go to Gao, Mali. That's where for 1 year, Gao's female basketball team was not able to dribble the ball or get on the court. That's because Islamist extremists who ruled northern Mali for most of 2012 imposed strict Sharia law, forcing women to cover their bodies in public. About 18 months later, French forces have pushed out the occupiers, and the team, like the rest of Mali's north, is slowly getting back on its feet. Katerina Heya met these women athletes in Gao and brings us their story.
As night falls over Gao in northern Mali, young women are practicing on a basketball court. Now that armed extremists have left, several girls in shiny tracksuit bottoms and low neck tops have joined the boys. Rama Tuture moves quickly across the basketball court's cracked surface. After 10 months of Islamist occupation and 1 year with no practice, the 19-year-old high school student is back in training. She says, as soon as classes are over for the day, she runs to practice or goes running with a friend. Toure says she does not get tired because she loves the game. Gao is known for its strong female basketball players, but Toure and many of her teammates had to sit on the sidelines due to the conflict that erupted in Mali in 2012. 18-year-old Maria Maiga says they could not wear shorts and tank tops normally worn on the basketball court, and only boys were allowed to play. While Gao was under the occupation of Al-Qaeda-linked Islamists, women were forced to cover their bodies in public, and men and women were banned from mixing socially. Violators faced public lashing or could have their hands chopped off. Women who refused to follow the dress code were arrested. Many also say they were raped. When the Islamists first arrived, Toure says she thought that she might just cover herself up and continue playing basketball. Instead, she boarded a bus heading south to the capital Bamako, together with tens of thousands of fleeing northerners. She says it was a tough year, as she not only didn't get to play, she couldn't go to school. Toure says she really missed the game. Now, with the situation calmer, most of the girls are back home and have a lot of catching up to do. Making sure they do so is Omar Tonku Sisse, a retired coach in his 60s. He is also the founder of the Center for Training and Promoting Sports in Gao. He welcomes his kids with a smile and a cigarette in hand next to the central pitch. But he recalls the occupation with bitterness.
Bon, en principe,
the armed groups, they were fools, he says. and he doesn't want to be reminded of those times. As soon as Gao was liberated by French troops in January 2013, Sisse's sports center resumed its activities, but unfortunately, he says, his girls' team lost many of its best players, as many families remain displaced in the south for fear of continuing insecurity in the north.
C'est des jeunes, donc il faudrait du temps pour pouvoir les initier.
It's a young team, as you can see, he says. Many of the players have a lot to learn. Some have more potential than the others, but Sisse says they are rebuilding step by step. Meanwhile, living conditions in Gao remain difficult. Jobs are scarce. Certain food items are hard to find. Some government services are still lacking. The whole city is still recovering, along with much of Mali's north. But the team is fortunate to find friendly competitions with squads from neighboring towns. Just as fortunate, says Toure, is the fact that they can play at all with sporadic fighting persisting.
Maintenant ça va mais pas comme avant parce que avant on va jouer jusqu'à.
Toure says while she's happy to be back, Gao is not the same city. She notes that they used to play until 9, sometimes 10 in the evening, but now must finish much earlier because of insecurity. She says even when there's fighting in Kidal or Menaka, it affects them in Gao, and on those days they must be home by 6 p.m. As a reminder of the Islamists' continued presence, a French army vehicle passes by on the road opposite the Sandy Court. There are rumors of the Tuareg rebels recruiting. For these basketball players in Gao, the coach says they can play an important role in restoring the city to the way it used to be by helping to keep young people focused on positive contributions they can make rather than being lured by armed groups.
Bon, c'est ce que j'ai dit aux enfants de mettre du sérieux, hein? De se mettre dans
Sisse
la tête
says all he and many Gao residents want is the best from the girls and to help them reach out to young people to rebuild a future. Katharina Höje for VOA News in Gao.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOANews.com.
And when you visit VOANews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled 8 World Cups, and I write about a new book by George Vesey, longtime sports columnist for the New York Times newspaper. In the book, the 75-year-old Vesey reflects on some of his experiences covering the 8 World Cup football tournaments before Brazil 2014.
VOA!
For our VOA listeners keeping score, that would be Spain 1982, Mexico 1986, Italy 1990, USA 1994, France 1998, Japan, South Korea 2002, Germany 2006, and South Africa 2010.
VOA!
My VOA colleague Park Brewer reached George Vesey by phone in New York and asked him, which World Cup was your favorite as a reporter?
Well, I want to sound like a parent here, which I am, and say, oh, I never have any favorites. Because everyone is different, everyone is special, blah, blah, blah. Now, I could look at it this way and say that the first one is always going to be special because it is first, and that was the one where Italy won, and I started off in Barcelona with that great group of Brazil, Argentina, and Italy. And then if you'd say, well, which one was your favorite as an individual, you know, the World Cups have been held in so many great places that the fun of living in these cities, I mean, four or five of them, my wife was with me. We rented apartments, if we were lucky enough, in Paris and Rome. So it's very hard. I know the one that I feel like I missed the most that I just didn't see was the one in the United States because the country is so big and I had to fly around. Also, I was living at home, so I didn't quite get, you know, when I was around New York, so I didn't quite get the feel of it that I did for the others.
Who was your favorite World Cup personality to cover?
If I say favorite, the guy I write about the most in the book is probably Maradona because I was witness in 82, about 10 rows up from the field, watching him get beaten up by Claudio Non Molto Gentile, not very gentle at all, and just pounding him, kicking Maradona. And then I wound up covering him in 86 with Before the Hand of God and being around him. And then in 90, I was trying to interview him, and I tell the story in the book about how I tried to make a phone call from the States to his house. Somebody gave me his number. And what happened when I made the phone call, I started first in my bad Italian, and then I switched to my bad Spanish, and this guy kept goofing with me on the phone. And then the punchline is who that actually was, and that's in the book.
George, how has covering the World Cup changed through the years? Obviously, it's more widely followed now than ever before, but certainly the changes in technology have had a huge impact for both writers and broadcasters and the way they reach their audiences.
Well, there's no doubt about it. I included some of this in the book. My editor said, well, people don't really care that much about the way you work. But I think that people who have come along in the computer age, who have seen things grow, can appreciate that the game of soccer didn't necessarily totally change in eight World Cups. But electronics, the way we, the world, do our business. So from a point of view of writing, when I started in 1982, I was working with a machine, a great big clumpy machine that actually had no battery backup. It had to operate on electric power. So somebody cut off the electricity in the press box after a game one night, not realizing what those people, and it totally blew out my machine. I had to go out and buy new parts to it to make it work the next day. So there is that. And then in terms of information, I couldn't look things up in 1982. There was no internet. FIFA doesn't give out much information anyway. They don't believe in really helping the reporters much. So it was hard to even get rosters of who people were. You go forward to 2010, and in South Africa, they had terrific electronics. Wherever you went, you could look up the players' backgrounds. You could look up, and everything graduated. The other thing to talk about electronics is the social media, how that affected things. I mean, 1982, I would file by computer, to be sure, by telephone, and you'd be like throwing a story in the bottle. You didn't even know how it was being received because you didn't see the newspaper till you got home. By 2010, and certainly in 2006, fans were using the social media to come back at you during games. Like you'd be getting emails from people saying, what's with that Bruce Arena? Why isn't he playing DeMarcus Beasley on the left side? Why is he playing him on the right side? Everybody knows he's got a love. And you'd be looking at this stuff and saying, those fans are right in the game at regular time, at warp time, and they're participating in just like the players.
That's George Vesey, the longtime sports columnist for the New York Times newspaper. George has a new book out titled Eight World Cups, and he was talking from New York with my VOA colleague Park Brewer. And that wraps up another expanded edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America engineer Audrius Regis for his technical support of the program. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
Eso pasa aquí.